Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Okay, so we come to our fourth and final gathering, examining St. Thomas Aquinas on just war, and we have adverted to war and its dynamics in previous times together. Now we attend to it more formally. And before we do that, just to remind us of the relevant principles, if you have it, if not, that's fine. Pull out the first handout you received from the second day, please. That has at the top of it St. Thomas Aquinas on Peace in the Summa Theologiae, Secunda Secundae, Roman numeral 2, hyphen Roman numeral 2, question 29. And I invite you to look at paragraph number 11, or number 11, according to my paragraphical divisions. This is taken from the Secunda Secundae of the Summa Theologiae, question 29, article 3, ad 3. And here we hear, peace is the work of justice indirectly, insofar as justice, and here's the key, justice removes the obstacles, the impediments to peace. So justice vis-a-vis peace, justice exercises an indirect role, causality. Why is it indirect? Because it doesn't touch on the term peace per se, union with the highest or the good, but rather removes obstacles that are standing in the way of our attainment of the good. So it's indirect. But peace is the work of charity directly, since charity, according to its very nature, causes peace. Peace is an effect of charity. For love is a unitive force, as Dionysius says, and peace is the union of the appetites, inclinations. So peace is the union of the appetites, inclinations. We recall that that is both intrinsic and extrinsic to the human, the agent. So you can speak. So peace is the union of appetitional or the appetites, inclinations again are the goods that are fundamentally the term of a nature. They're like the arrows. They're the nature's tiltedness. There's no such thing as natural prime matter, as if that's what the world thinks today. We are now God. Everything is pure potency. We impose a form, give it its shape. No, everything exists and has a shape already, has a tiltedness, an inclination. So you are meant in your humanity naturally for sensible goods. In your will, you are meant for universal goodness and everything within it, including sensible goods and everything in between. And in your intellect, you are made for truth. There will never be a day when a human person is perfected by sensible evils, universal evil, and error. Because we're tilted one directionally towards those formalities. So peace is the union of the appetites, inclinations, and ultimately that has to be in the terminal sense, in the universal good, which is God, in the absolute sense, but there's also relative goodnesses. But we also remember that it's also integral, insofar as the various inclinations and appetites of the human person also have to be united. You experience dissonance internally if your sense appetites and your rational appetite are in tension. So there has to be an integral, unified, internally union of appetitional movements, activations, and they have to be unified also terminally. Charity is the cause of peace because it is this terminal union with the highest good, which can only be attained if all of the human person enters into it. So in other words, you can't be united to God rationally if your sense appetitional movements are completely disordered. This is a very important spiritual point which bears repeating, and if I could have the microphone of the radios of the world, I would say this for the next year straight. No one goes to heaven accidentally. No one goes to heaven accidentally. I'm just, oh my goodness, I've never thought of goodness or something beyond me, and wow, God, hey, I'm Mark. Jesus, hey, nice to meet you. No, not everyone may know explicitly, fully, comprehensively the gospel message in all of its dimensions, but no one encounters supernatural, beatific goodness and is united to it by mistake. Even naturally, that's on the side of the object, God, but on our side, no one is happy by mistake. I was just living my life. I didn't really give it any thought. And, you know, I'm just really fulfilled. Impossible to be happy, which is the effect of virtue, to be virtuous, naturally and supernaturally, requires intentionality and deliberation. So, that intentionality and deliberation, under the influence of grace, result in peace, which means integrally, internally, eternally, with the extrinsic perfective good that is beyond us, but which we seek and can attain and be united to, we have peace. Charity is the cause of peace because it is the union with this good and also requires that we be integrally perfected and integrated. And justice, where we are going to look at just war right now, removes obstacles to peace. Okay? So that's where we're focusing. Keep that, please. We will keep that in the back of our minds. On the handout you have received for this morning, you saw this, but I provided a resume or a brief restatement or another version, same thing, but just a slightly different translation of question 40 as a whole. You'll notice or you recall that there are four articles, and in question 40, under obstacles to peace, that's where we're at, article 1 asks whether some kind of war is licit. And Articles 2, 3, and 4 ask, respectively, whether it is licit for clerics. Today, clerics are priests, but historically they were people, not always priests, ordained, but in some way of standing in the sacred order. Whether it is licit for clerics to combat or to war, to fight, the lare, forgot a question mark there. Typos bother me, but I'm going to pretend that I don't see that. Article, that's my fault too. Article 3, whether it is licit for those who combat or war, fight to use ambushes. And Article 4, whether it is licit to fight, war, combat on holy days. We won't get into it now, but Aquinas is here following in an abbreviated format the method of certain knowledge that he outlines in his commentary on Aristotle's Posterior Analytics. The greatest need of contemporary philosophy and theology in the Thomistic world is to reappreciate and understand what's going on in the Posterior Analytics. It is hard. It is boring. But if you can get into, there's no Thomist today that really has it. James Weissipel and William Augustine Wallace were the last two in terms of doing it kind of formally, writing about it a lot in a consistent way. But if you get the Posterior Analytics, you can predict everything Aquinas does. He just follows this. And so from Article 1, he asks for a definition in the existence of it. Is there such a thing as war that is licit? And what would that mean? The existence of something and the nature of something. And then he asks in Articles 2, 3, and 4, the characteristics, the modalities of this war, which is licit, which does exist and has certain characteristics. And so what I've done here, for the sake of time and hopefully intelligibility, is I've rearranged some of these things, but in a way that hopefully will serve our intelligibility in an abbreviated way. Number one, paragraph number one. Those who wage just war intend peace. Very important, intendunt. This is not a throwaway word, because intentionality always sets us up in a movement, a motion of some sort, whether on first act or second act, towards an end. And the end always has the nature of the good. So right from the beginning, when Aquinas is talking about war, which is just, he's pointing out that the intentionality involved here, the movement, the shape, the defining characteristics of peace, it's peace as an end. So peace is not an afterthought in a just war. In fact, it is the formal purpose of a just war. We wage just war to obtain peace. Why is the end so important? It is important because, in this context, in any context, because without an end, no action would come to be. An endless action is impossible. And per impossibile, if you could have an action begin without an end, it's impossible. It's just a matter. No action would ever end. Complete. Because it only completes when it's attained its term. And no action begins without some purpose. And purpose here, don't think of the end only as kind of the outward destiny. What's your goal? We're going to the Supreme Court, you know, in a place, you know, that is an end. What we mean by end here is also the very directionality of any temporal contingent movement. So the end is not just out there, it is, but it's also in here because I am moving toward it. So the end shapes the whole of reality. So when he emphasizes peace or being very precise, he's presupposing that we've already studied and mastered the prima pars, which is the most important part of the suit. If you figure that out, everything else kind of follows. But even that, the prima secundae, we're in the secunda secundae. He says, well, they know the importance of intention and intent. And he's saying, peace, this is the end. This is the goal. This is essential to understanding his treatment of just war. So those who wage just war intend peace. And so they are not opposed to peace except to the evil peace, the fake peace, the dissimulated peace, which our Lord, quote, came not to send upon earth. And hence, dear St. Augustine says, we do not seek peace in order to be at war, but we go to war that we may have peace. Be peaceful, therefore, in warring, so that you may vanquish those whom you war against and bring them to the prosperity of peace. This is the final cause, peace, the end, the cause of all causes, war as just, a specific kind of war. Again, we're trying to find a definition, the nature of war, Article 1, following the posterior analytics, the nature of which is about certain knowledge and even wisdom. This is essential because it specifies the whole thing. There is no such thing as a just war that's not ordered to peace. Number 2, as stated above, and I have that stated above in the following paragraphs. This is what he says right after what we've just read. He continues. This is in Article 2, but we're going to look at something from earlier. As stated above, every power, art, or virtue that pertains to or belongs to, pertinet, the end, every power, capacity, art, or virtue that belongs to the end, has to dispose that which is directed to the end. That which is directed to the end, eque sunt ad finem, that's the means. Every power, virtue, or art, a capacity for acting, a way of acting, a skill set of acting, that's ordered, belongs to an end, has to, in the execution, shape the means, so that the means look like the end. Let's imagine the end looks like a triangle, capital triangle. If I have an art, a capacity, a skill set that can achieve this end, and I achieve the end through respective means, that means, the various steps must themselves have a certain, not complete, but they must resemble, have the same shape as that to which I go towards. That's critical. So he's framing the end, the agent, with the power, art, virtue, which we execute towards the end, and then even the proportionate means, the means fit to the end. A means that's shaped like this, that's not going to help us get here. Maybe there's another type of means. Maybe there's a means that's just like a line. Well, that might still help us because the triangle... And for those listening, you are very confused at the moment. But triangles are made up of lines. This will not help us. So my favorite example, just to help us get this a little bit better, this is where pure intentionality is always realism. So let's imagine we're at the Grand Canyon and it's very hot. There's a huge, you know, and let's say some of you are engineering geniuses, and we got to build a bridge to get across the Grand Canyon. And we have different instruments at our disposal. We have, first of all, a big pile of lumber and saws and hammers and nails. Some of you are thinking, okay, I could do that. I could build a bridge. Good. We also have steel and rivets and whatever you use to put steel and rivets together. We also have, on another place, ice cubes. Big pile of them. Melting by the moment. And then feathers, which Father Pine is frantically trying to keep from blowing away. Now, our intention, our object, our end, our objective is to get across the Grand Canyon to build a bridge. But no matter how sincere I am, no matter how authentically I might plan it, if I try to build a bridge out of ice cubes or feathers, that's a doomed thing. Why? Because the nature of ice cubeness and featherness is not proportioned to the nature of my end. While wood or metal, steel, iron, is. Either or could work. That's why intentionality is not sufficient. Intentionality in the sense of just kind of an abstract idea in my mind. No, I have to have means that are proportioned, that fit with the attainment of the purpose. So Aquinas is making the same point here. The means have to reflect and be proportionate to the end. And if the end of war is peace, if it's just, so the means must be proportioned to that. He says, okay, now continuing. He doesn't leave it vague. He goes on. Now among the faithful, believers, Christians, carnal wars, bella carnalia, you know, very earthy, graphic, bloody, even, should be considered as having for their end the divine spiritual good to which clerics are deputed. I know we're going to get to the cleric question briefly, don't worry, but look, he's pointing out that in a just war, it's not as if this platform, this stage, reality takes a break. What Aquinas is not saying is, people are being cruel to you unjustly, your lives are in danger. Okay, forget the order of reality. I give you permission to do what I normally say you can't. The end, God, supernatural goodness, remains for believers the end, whether or not it's a moment of tranquility or whether it's a moment of great antagonism, frustration, perturbation. Okay? So that's very important. Often, and this is why Dr. Hittinger, Dr. Reichberg's work is so important for reminding people, this isn't just, again, about rules and laws. This is about reality. Aquinas is interested in knowing the way things are. Just war theory is not, when does God let us take off our seatbelt in the car of life? No. Even in a context where just war is proper, and not just proper, necessary, necessaria comes up later, it's still towards the same finality. Okay? All right. Now, you'll notice in number two at the beginning, he invokes something he said earlier. As stated above, he's talking about the Secunda Secundae, question 23, article 4, odd 2, which I have included. This is from a different part of the Summa earlier in number 3. Number 3 says, the virtue or art, which is concerned about the last end, commands, executes, directs the virtues or arts, which are concerned about other ends, which are secondary. Thus, the military art commands the art of horse riding. So militaristic exercises and purposes can be done without horse riding, but if horse riding is useful, they are deployed. And by they, I mean horse riding is deployed for the sake of militaristic exercises. Therefore, we specify that act of riding a horse in relation to military activities. Okay, accordingly, here's the key, back to charity. Since charity has for its object the last end of human life, namely everlasting happiness, peace, it follows that it, charity, extends to the acts of a man's whole life by commanding them, not by eliciting immediately all acts of virtue. Notice Aquinas in number 2 invokes something earlier, number 3. Number 3 talks about charity and the order of execution. which means that implicit in what he's saying here in question 40, article 2, is that charity needs to be present in a just world, at least if it's engaged in by believers, okay? He doesn't see this as inimical. There's always an evil to war. You read the Cardinal Cotier essay? Marvelous. So we're not saying evil war becomes good in itself, objectively. However, you can still be in charity, not in mortal sin, and be involved in a just war, okay? In fact, you must be if you're going to do it right. Number 4, this is from Article 2. St. Thomas says, several things are necessary for the good of a human society. I changed the brackets there. The word, I forget the other word, but necessary, necessaria, is a very important word, so we're going to keep it literal. Not optional. While certain occupations are so inconsistent with one another that they cannot be fittingly exercised at the same time. Now, warlike pursuits are altogether incompatible with the duties of a bishop and a cleric. Okay. The first reason is a general one, because to wit, warlike pursuits are full of unrest. Maximus inquietudines. Why is that? He's looking at different states in life. So we've got a society, we have a corporate group of people who can participate in certain warlike activities. Clerics and bishops know. Why? Because these war activities have within them the greatest disquietudes. They're the most anti-rest. And what's fascinating is he's implicitly saying here, well, not just implicit, but it's explicit, is that the purpose of religious life, priesthood, et cetera, is that you're united with God supernaturally. That's your, not just your job. You can stop your job. That's your identity. So it's a contradiction for a cleric who's supposed to be, even in this life, pursuing in, relishing in, residing in the peace and quiet and tranquility of union with God, to engage in things which are objectively not that. Warlike pursuits are full of unrest, so that they hinder the mind very much from the contemplation of divine things, the praise of God and prayers of the people, which belong to the duties of a cleric. The second reason is a special one. This is also very touching, because to wit, all the clerical orders are directed to the ministry of the altar, Mass, on which the Passion of Christ is represented or represented sacramentally. And thus they, the clerics, the priests, should be ready to shed their own blood for Christ so as to imitate the indeed what they portray or enact in their ministries. The priest always dies first. Like Father Andrew, Father Pine, priest. We don't say this is his body, this is my body. That's why the priest receives the sacred body and precious blood first. Just as on the cross, Christ's body and blood were separated. That's the sacrifice. He died. So on the altar, sacramentally, same sacrifice, but as Cardinal Cajetan reminds us, the mode of sacrifice is different. Sacramentally, under the appearances of bread and wine, his body and blood are separated through him, with him, and in him. But it's because of this supernatural end. The priesthood is specified by the sacrifice of Christ and entering into that, and by the quietude, the peace that comes from union with that. It is not, therefore, fitting, appropriate, proportioned that we engage that in warlike activities, okay? Number 5. For a war to be just, 3 things are necessary. Here we go. These are the 3 conditions that you are familiar with, that Cardinal Cotier outlined, that Professor Reichberg has exposited many times, and that even Wikipedia kind of gets right, which is amazing. So, in order for a war to be just, 3 things are necessary. First, the authority of the sovereign, principis, by whose command the war is to be waged. So you have to have the authority of the sovereign. For it is not the business of a private individual to declare war, because he can seek for redress of his rights from the tribunal of his superior. Moreover, it is not the business of a private individual to summon together the people, which has to be done in wartime. And as the care of the commonweal, the cura republice commissa, is committed to those who are in authority, it is their business, the sovereign authority or tees, to watch over the commonweal, the care of the republic, kingdom, or province subjected to them. What is he saying here? These are not just throwaway reasons. So Aquinas is saying that the princeps, the sovereign, Why does he have it? He's looking at he alone or they, you know, depending on the form of government, the good government. But the first reason, it is not the business of a private individual to declare war, because he can seek for redress of his rights from the tribunal of his superior. So what his argument there is saying is that an individual, as an individual, stands beneath, under the authority of someone above them. To be an individual, to not be the sovereign, the princeps, means that you are not in and of yourself at the head. You don't have civil headship. Therefore, you can seek from the head this resolution to problems. And what he's doing here vis-a-vis the princeps is he's looking at him, the princeps, the guy, in relation to others. There is no one above him in the civil sphere. He has no recourse except to God, which will come up later. So there, because there is no further recourse that he can take within the civil order in which he exists, he is the one that must make the adjudication of whether or not there can be a war. If we're over here, no, there's another one above us, but there's no one else, if you're the sovereign leader of a nation, for you to appeal to. Therefore, the buck stops there or starts there. And then the second reason, moreover, it is not the business of a private individual to summon together the people. Now he's looking at the others in relation to the princeps. It is not the case that an individual, as an individual, by definition, does not have the authority, the power, the competence to bring together to a corporate body, de jure, a group of people for a common purpose, even if it's a good one. But because the princeps is at the head and is representative in himself of us all, in a way we are all in him and he is with all of us, therefore he does have that in his identity, the capacity to bring us all together. So in fact, the relationality that Aquinas identifies and looks at here is very interesting. Okay. Skipping down a little bit, and just, this is still number 5, just as it is lawful for them, the principes, to have recourse to the sword in defending the common weal against what? Internal disturbances. Remember yesterday and before, we've looked at the fact that within the human person, you have internal disturbances and external disturbances to peace. Now he's doing that socially. You can have a social unity. There can be internal disturbances. Those are called miscreants that cause trouble and problems. It's the government's job to keep them from, you know, destroying the Catholic University of America or from your local Walmart, et cetera, et cetera. That's their job. Internal obstacles to peace, it's the job of the sovereign to prevent that internal. And so, too, it is their business to have recourse to the sword of war in defending the common weal, the republic, against external enemies. Internal and external impediments to peace. So what we looked at with regard to the appetites, natural et alia, on the level of being and operation. Then we looked at within the human person, internal, external peace, how our appetites work together, where they attain the goal. Now he's looking at people in society according to the same intrinsic and extrinsic. Perfective union with the good, disturbances, frustrations, impediments to peace, internal and external. This is why we did all that we did, in case you, at least I'm hoping it was why. You might still feel like that was a waste of time, but all right. So that's what he's saying, and the princeps, I mean, in a sense, is coterminal with this, represents this, expresses this, guides this. Okay. Society, that's what this is for the tape. It's not tape. We don't use tape anymore. That's called internet people. Okay. Secondly, number 6. So you need to have the authority of the sovereign is the one that can declare war in a just situation. Secondly, and this is key, a just cause is required. Namely, that those who are attacked by us engaging in a just war should be attacked because they deserve to be attacked on account of some fault. Propter aliquam culpam impugnationem meriantur. Wherefore, Augustine says, back to Holy Father Augustine, a just war is wont to be described as one that avenges wrongs when a nation or state has to be punished for refusing to make amends for the wrongs inflicted by its subjects or to restore what it has seized unjustly. A just cause is required, which means there has to be. What's justice do? It removes objective impediments to peace. It can't just be because I want to get my donuts cheaper and your country does that, therefore we're coming. That's not really an impediment to peace. There has to be a proportioned, fit, causally appropriate, effectually sufficient, without being excessive response to an objective disturbance in the order of peace. We're going to come back to that. That's really the key here. It's essential. And then thirdly, so we have reason number one, the agent, representative agent of a just war. Second, we have the cause, the final cause. And then third, we have the modality. How is a just war to be exercised? Thirdly, it is necessary that the belligerents, those fighting, should have a rightful intention. Back to this. That is, by which they intend the advancement of good or the avoidance of evil, which Dr. Reichberg has emphasized that that's critical to Aquinas' understanding of just war. A rightful intention. So it's not just enough for me to be like, you know, I'm just an angry, disturbed person that collects guns and knives and watches every, you know, horrible movie with much violence and macabre matters, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, Emperor Hofer says, we are going to war. I'm like, yes, let us, you know, unleash my fury on, you know, the country where the donuts are cheaper. No. So what's going on here is the intentionality, the nature, the purpose of reason number two, just cause, that the number one, the sovereign recognizes, we all have to participate in that intentionality in our own cognition. So there's two senses of intention. Intention is what is happening, and intention is also what I'm doing, why. Hence, Augustine says, again, true religion looks upon as peaceful those wars that are waged not for the motives of aggrandizement or cruelty, but with the object of securing peace. I have to possess, we have to possess in ourselves, subjectively, as the acting agents executing this intention, our intention has to correspond to this intention. We want peace. For it may happen that the war is declared by the legitimate authority, Emperor Hofer, for a just cause. They're storming our borders and prevent great injustice, and yet be rendered unlawful through a wicked intention. Now's our chance, you know, to get revenge, because one day that Emperor Bill over there looked at me funny, and I've never forgiven him that. No. Hence, Augustine says, contra faustum, the passion for inflicting harm, the cruel thirst for vengeance, an unpacific and relentless spirit, the fever of revolt, the lust of power, and such like things, all these are rightly condemned in war. So those are the three criteria. To have a just war, it has to be done, executed by the sovereign who has the jurisdiction to do so. It has to be objectively the nature of a just cause. It must be proper. Can't just be for any reason. And thirdly, the intentionality of the objectivity of a just war movement must be reflected in those who engage it for its very nature. We must intend a just war justly. And again, justice, what is that again? Removing impediments to peace. Now, for a little clarification, I have done you the great joy of maybe even reading for the first time, some of you, I know not for the professors, but Cardinal Cajetan, one of the most brilliant men of history. Not perfect, but he has a footnote in his commentary here. Listen to this. This is a wonderful thing. Cajetan helps us remember what is at the heart of these just war criteria. He says, I was going to give you Banyas, but he has pages and pages and pages, so I didn't want to give you that. But Cajetan is a little more succinct. Cajetan says, observe that since a just cause is another condition of a just war, another meaning of second, and the authority by which it is indicated is another, the sovereign. He said these are two necessary elements of a just war, the authority and the condition of justice. It is necessary, Cajetan says, to pay attention in wars not only to the authority of the commander, but also to the cause. So he's saying, let's focus on number two. And hence, to take that no authority is sufficient for the justice of war, if justice is wanting or lacking in the cause. So you could have the legitimate, you know, Emperor Hofer could say, let's go to war. He has the authority, but if it's not a just war, that doesn't make it just simply because it's been decreed by the emperor. Whence? And then look, what does he do? He goes to the Pope. Whence it may be that he looks to the Pope to induce war. Pope Hofer, as is said in this letter, yet if the Pope were to declare war, it must not therefore be just simply from the fact that it's declared. Since a person who functions by the authority of the papacy may be unjust and affected by the lust of domination, there we go, libido dominandi, or revenge, as well as having other abnormal crimes. Nor are they excused, that's us, from giving him help in war without a just cause. Just as they do not minister or assist to him in robbery, murder, witchcraft, adultery, lust, and the like. So Cajetan says, even if the Pope, in which at that time you did have a certain civil authority and the highest sacred authority, he too has capital A authority. And yet, you can't leave the objective requirements for this. Brilliant. Okay. Number nine. This is in reference to Augustine's Contra Faustum. To have recourse to the sword as a private person by the authority of the sovereign or judge, or as a public person through zeal for justice and by the authority, so to speak, of God, is not to take the sword, but to use it as commissioned by another. Wherefore, it does not deserve punishment. This, the three criteria that he lists for just war, render all those combatants, they are not acting in and of themselves. Therefore, they are not taking the sword, which signals and denotes a certain, this is my project, this is my war, therefore my actions vis-a-vis you are mine alone. You are administrated, ordered to a certain greater good by those who have legitimate authority, and even in a certain respect, absolutely by God, because God has ordained that there should be authorities that have influence over people, even if those authorities are bad themselves or corrupt. Okay? All right. This one is precious. Number 10. In case you think everyone reading Aquinas, he expects us to rub our hands together with great excitement, so let's get ready. I hope a just war opportunity comes. That is not the case. Citing Matthew 5:39, Romans 12:19, which is in the objections, which say, you know, I say to you not to resist evil, Matthew 5, not revenging yourself, don't revenge, Romans 12. Aquinas says, such like precepts, as Augustine observes, should always be borne in readiness of mind, so that we be ready to obey them, and, if necessary, to refrain from resistance or self-defense. Cajetan and Banias have a lot to say that prudence, regnative prudence, plays a lot in. There are times when sometimes you have to take a little injustice. But, nevertheless, it is necessary sometimes for a man to act otherwise for the common good, or for the good of those with whom he is fighting. So he's not saying, it's interesting, Aquinas notes there's still a little bit of where recta ratio agibilium, the prudence comes in, where even if you have all the criteria, that doesn't necessarily mean A plus B plus C equals just war. The regnative prudence has to enter into this, okay? Now, last couple things. Aquinas now is looking at the modality of this. Okay, all right, so just war is licit, as removing impediments to peace. It would seem that there's a lot of things that attend this just removal that are unpleasant, like lying, dishonesty, deception, manipulation, trickery. The Christian tradition has never been a big fan of that. How would that work? And so Aquinas analyzes that. He says, laying ambushes in order to deceive the enemy. Okay, I missed. Type that, to deceive the enemy. Now, a man may be deceived by another's word or deed in two ways. It's like there's two ways to be deceived. First, through being told something false or through breaking a promise. And this is always unlawful. Why is that? It's because the nature of communication is to communicate what I think and where we are. So it's literally a disordered act line, because the purpose of my communication is to bring us together in at least a conversation. And if I'm lying to you, I'm doing the opposite of that in the very act of that is unitive. Okay. Secondly, so that you can't ever lie, not even war. Secondly, a man may be deceived by what we say or do because we do not declare our purpose or meaning to him. This is where I'm not lying, but I don't have to always manifest why I'm doing or what I'm doing. There's a distinction there. And it's fascinating. Look at what he does. He goes to the Sakra Doctrina explicitly. He says, secondly, that's sacred doctrine, question one of the Summa. A man may be deceived by what we say or do because we do not declare our purpose or meaning to him. Now, we are not always bound to do this, declare everything about everything. Since even in the sacred doctrine, Doctrina Sacra, many things have to be concealed, especially from unbelievers, lest they deride it. So he says that there are even in the holiest divine revelation, not all things are known to all people. It's not a Gnostic gospel, but it is a precious gospel, and it's shared and explained with those who are well-disposed. So if even on the highest, God's own divine revelation, there's a certain concealment at times. Therefore, also in human interactions, much less sublime than the Sacra Doctrina, you can also have an appropriate concealment. That's a strong argument by appealing to the nature of the Sacra Doctrina, which is at the heart of the Summa Theologiae. The Summa Theologiae is like a long footnote to question one, just the way it's structured. That's a profound point. He goes to the Sacra Doctrina to say it is not objectively wrong not to manifest everything to everyone. And then you look at number 12, we're winding down here. Nor can these ambushes be properly, so, you know, doing things and surprising your enemy, but you didn't deceive them through speech, etc. Nor can these ambushes be properly called frauds, fraudes, nor are they contrary to justice or to an ordered will. Those are two are ordered to justice, the removing of impediments in the way of peace. And here's a key thing. This might surprise people in the 21st century. For it would be a disordered will. Disorder. If someone wanted others to hide nothing from him. Which means transparency is not a virtue. Transparency is not an end. It would be disordered, not good, not conducive to the union of a social or an individual person towards the perfective good proportioned to the social or to the individual. Today, we make the transparency everything. Again, no deception, not cover up, none of that, but transparency as an end. An exhibitionism, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, all the other things I try to stay away from. Because what that does is that actually breaks down peace, because what it's doing in this kind of the supremacy of transparency is in order to have the union of peace, you need to still retain some distinction. Because we are still two different people. And yet we can be united truly, profoundly in a common good. However, ultimately what happens is the modern preoccupation with transparency as an end forgets this and reduces it to here, where it's you and me, you know everything about me, I know everything about you and everything about your country, what you're doing. And then the problem is when you have just this without the third perfect external point of union, then you get, ironically, the opposite of peace. Because now I use what I know about you against you, or you're afraid I will, or it becomes me versus you. These two individuals lose themselves, or I should say they're united in something beyond them without the risk of us, if it's just you and I. Okay, can't get into that because we're at time. And then 13, you can see it. He looks at another condition, paragraph 13 of my handout, for why it's not wrong to fight on a holy day. So it's very interesting what Aquinas does in the Just Sport. Of course, I defer to Professor Breitberg and Dr. Hittinger for their expertise. They've been doing this specific topic and set of topics for a long time. But the key thing is nothing is intelligible. Nothing exists without order, nature order to an end. No human person acts without some order to an end. No society exists without some order to an end. No God himself has an end. The end is to be. That's what he is. That's good. Pure goodness is the end, union with that. And therefore, if just war is just, it is not just God says, take off the seatbelt. It's okay. We'll put a pause on the law. No, it is regrettable, unfortunate, but still ordered to the good, which is peace, by removing obstacles which have unfortunately encroached upon the Ordo Pacis.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.